Welcome to this season of Future Makers Brain and Mental Health. I'm Professor Belinda Lennox. I'm a psychiatrist and a researcher here in Oxford. And this season, you'll be joining me as we demystify the science behind the most complex object in the known universe, our brains, and look at the wide-reaching impacts of mental illness on individuals and society. I'll be introducing you to some of Oxford's best academic minds working to solve the greatest challenges in brain and mental health. And I'll also be speaking to guests from beyond the university to bring their perspectives and lived experience and get a sense of the impact of what we're doing. Join us as we discover how Oxford is shaping the future of brain and mental health research. So welcome to this episode of Future Makers on suicide and suicide prevention. I'm really delighted to be joined by my guest, Ben West. And Ben West is a mental health campaigner, a best-selling author and social media influencer. And he has done amazing work, actually, in raising awareness of mental health and particularly around suicide. So welcome, Ben. It's lovely to be speaking with you.
Thank you so much for having me on, Belinda.
No problem. And do you just want to start? Do you just want to tell us a bit about why this topic is so important to you?
Absolutely. So first of all, being introduced like that always feels really strange because this is just so unexpected, such an unexpected turn of my life. I mean, to think that I'd be on a podcast one day talking to someone from the University of Oxford about, and being introduced to a social media influencer, which I still makes me cringe a little bit. And being introduced as a mental health campaigner, a suicide prevention campaigner is surprising because I really didn't expect any of this to happen. And I guess to explain my story, I need to go back to when I was 17 years old. So at the time I was in secondary school. I grew up in Kent with two other brothers and in the middle of nowhere. I had Sam, who was just younger than me, and then Tom, who was younger than Sam. So that was three of us. And we had a great upbringing in Kent. Really lovely school, lovely community, lovely place to live, just fields for days. And it was like a little adventure, and you got to live with your best friends, and it was amazing. So I was, you get to the point where I'm 17. I was just starting my A-levels. Sam was doing his GCSEs, and Tom was in what must have been year seven, and the dynamic sort of started to change, and I sort of noticed it changing because that dynamic of being best friends with your brothers and mucking around and being really, really close, it did start to shift. And Sam became in 2017 a little bit more isolated from the family and from getting involved and became, he started to change a lot. And he was diagnosed with depression, clinical depression, in September 2017. And I remember being told, and I never spoke to him about it because for me, I had no idea what depression was. Like I'm sure most people that are in this situation, especially at that age, I honestly thought my mum had told me that he'd been diagnosed as feeling a little bit sad. And so I never spoke to him about it. And then in January 2018, he took his own life at 15 years old. Me and my mum found him. It was, without a doubt, the one of the worst things I could ever imagine having to deal with. It was just awful. I look back now, I'm incredibly lucky that I had first aid training. So I sort of knew what to do in the immediate situation. But you know, as a 17-year-old boy, you shouldn't be doing CPR on your brother. It was not nice. And he passed away. And here I am being introduced to a suicide prevention campaigner because I think it's just so desperately sad that a 15-year-old boy was put in a situation where he took his own life. I think that's so sad. And obviously in my work, I see that so much nowadays. I mean, so many people in the same situation, and suicidality and suicidal thoughts are rife in the world at the moment, and especially in young people, but for everyone. It does make me incredibly sad and also incredibly driven to make sure that we can help as many people in Sam's position as possible, because, you know, I'd do anything to go back and have a conversation with him and make sure he was okay, but I can't. What I can do is try my best to get out there, influence policy, work with people, speak to amazing people like you and the guests you've got on, and really get brains together and really just try and help these people that are so lost and alone and really struggling.
It's such a powerful and absolutely horrendous story, Ben. You know, and I'm feeling, you know, sick just hearing it. And it's a complete tragedy, as each and every suicide is for every family. And especially at such a young age. Your response to it, as you say, you've been on an absolute mission to improve the situation and raise awareness. I mean, just tell us a little bit, how did you sort of take that path?
Well, to be honest, I didn't really have much of a choice. I think, you know, we talk around, this is where we start to get into the realm of how fascinating I find all of this. And I mentioned at the start when we were just chatting before we started recording, I find the mental health world and psychology and emotional health absolutely fascinating, especially going through it myself and now being able to look back and realize the complexity of this thing inside my head that was just navigating this awful situation. And for me, going into advocacy work and campaigning work and try and do something positive, it was almost like a reflex. There was no choice involved. And I guess it came out of a few different places. One was an enormous amount of guilt. Everyone sort of looks at it on the surface and goes, oh, you're doing such an amazing thing. You must be so lovely. Actually, it came out of a deep, deep sense of hatred for myself, because just before Sam died, we actually had an argument. And so the last thing I'd ever say to him was not a nice thing. That played on my mind hugely, to the point where I thought I'd caused all of it. So actually doing something good and trying to help other people, one of the reasons for that was trying to prove to myself and everyone that actually I wasn't such a bad person. I needed to sort of do something positive to right that wrong. Obviously, I know now that that's completely misplaced guilt. But at the time, it felt like I had to do something good. But also, I started speaking to people at school and I realized that genuinely almost every single person I spoke to had something going on behind the scenes: depression, anxiety, anorexia, bulimia, suicidal thoughts. Just it felt endless, the number of conversations I was having with people. And a large part of me felt sad about those conversations and wanted to help them, genuinely wanted to help them. But I think an even larger part of me, and I remember talking to a friend of mine at school actually and saying this, felt terror, because I knew, and I said this to this friend, I wouldn't survive losing someone else like this. And I was like, I just can't do that. I can't do it again. And so I think for those sort of mixture of emotions, I just naturally went, well, we're going to have to try and do something here. And, you know, it's been almost 6 years. So I'm in too deep now to get out.
Yeah. And what did you find? Because as you say, it's such a common experience, isn't it? So many teenagers, young people have mental health problems, and actually suicidal thoughts are incredibly common. And your particular focus is on the response of the education system, is it? I mean, is it around the school environment? Do you think more could be done?
I do. I think in terms of campaigning from a policy point of view, I definitely think the area that I can have most impact is through policies in education, in schools, and in universities. That for me feels like the where I can have most progress. You know, everyone can talk about roles of the NHS and roles of all of this, and that is important, having that support. But for me, early intervention, creating better structures in schools for support and education, it just feels like a no-brainer, and also something I can speak to well. But it comes from me being at school, and one of the first things I did, one of the first events I did, was a big charity walk at school. And it was actually a conversation I had there on that walk with Sam's teachers and my teachers. And they turned around to me and they were just like, Ben, we see this all the time. We see self-harm injuries in our classroom all the time. We see students in crisis all the time, and we have no idea what to say. And I discovered then that there was no statutory requirement for teachers to be given any training on mental health in their PGCE or any teacher training qualifications. And that for me struck me as a little bit odd. We know the scale of the mental health crisis. We know how important it is to have early intervention at a young age. And we've got teachers who want to help, largely want to help and want to intervene, but don't have the training to do so. And it just felt like a missed opportunity to not implement that training, which actually is quite basic training, into PGCE and teacher training standards. So that really led me on to a more policy driven approach. And that's sort of, for the last 5.5 years, that sort of campaignery, activisty policy angle has sort of laid alongside, the other perspective of what I do, which is just trying to get people talking quite positive mental health events and language about helping and how we can talk to each other and volunteering for certain charities and doing that. But no, there is a definite policy campaigning line that I go on, but majority of the stuff I do is around education, for sure.
Yeah, and how have you found your experience of working at a sort of government policy level?
Got to be careful what I say. Slow. Slow. It's incredibly difficult, because especially with mental health, it's a health issue, but it's also an education issue. So when you go to the government, what happens is the Department of Health goes, it's not us, you got to be talking to education. And the Department of Education goes, but this is a health problem. And you end up getting sort of bounced between the two. And so it's quite difficult. And with mental health, we're in this really amazing space now. And we're in a great position now where actually it's become very nonpartisan. It doesn't have a political color. It doesn't have a political affinity. Pretty much everyone across the political spectrum knows that we need to tackle this mental health crisis we're in and stopping suicide. No one disagrees with that, which is great. But what we do see is and what the challenge I have is actually trying to pin down who's responsible for it. And that's not that people are trying to avoid responsibility necessarily, but it's actually about understanding who is in a government that's very secular and deals with very different issues. We've got this issue that crosses a gap between two departments, and that is a headache sometimes. it's progress, and it's very slow. I've been told by numerous civil servants that we're not going to see legislative statutory change for 8-10 years. So it's a long process, but you've got to just give that process a push at the beginning to get it going. And that's really what I try and do. And then just encourage it along a little bit.
Well, completely. And I suppose, as you say, actually everybody accepts that this is a hugely important area. And you've won over the hearts and minds. I mean, so actually, maybe the legislation might be slow in arriving, but actually the case of need is accepted, isn't it? And actually the solutions that you're proposing are extremely achievable, aren't they? You're not asking for a complete restructure of our education system. You're asking for all teachers to have a level of mental health first aid, awareness, which is absolutely not unreasonable.
No, and the government agrees, right? They've already got a program that trains mental health first aiders in schools. I just think it's completely unsustainable and a waste of money what they're doing at the moment. You're basically taking a member of staff out of a school for 2 days, training them, putting them back into school. You've got then one mental health first aider in a school of, say, 1,000. I mean, the impact of that is negligible, right? And that's a huge cost. And then the time cost as well of taking a teacher out of school for 2 days. But we already have a training system in place for every teacher that has to go through qualification. Why on earth are we not updating the statutory requirements so that we eventually end up with a education system where everyone has got a basic understanding of this anyway? That to me is everyone, anything you do with the government, they want to know if it's cost effective. That seems like an incredibly cost effective way of revolutionizing and putting the foundations into creating amazingly mental health friendly, that's an awful phrase to use, mental health friendly schools that are well capable of looking after students' mental health. It makes sense to me, and it makes sense to most people, because it's a sensible idea.
Completely, yes.
Hello, I hope you're enjoying this episode of Future Makers Brain and Mental Health. If you'd like to learn more about our work here in Oxford, head to ox.ac.uk/brain or let us know what you think on social media using the hashtag OxfordBrain.
Do you want to say a bit about how you went about writing your book?
My book. So I guess for me, suicide does still have, we talk a lot about stigma in mental health. I think suicide still has an enormous stigma. People talk about it more than ever, don't get me wrong, and we can talk about it very openly, but I think the nitty gritty of what it actually is still quite shrouded in secrecy. It's still quite taboo. And I found that, and I really just wanted to, in a world of TikTok and algorithms and 15-second videos, I really just wanted an opportunity to tell my story from 2017 to now, get it all on paper, give the details. What is it actually like to go through that? Because we can't have a sensible, proper debate about, you know, how we move forward with funding and research and education and health without actually understanding what the problem is. And so I wanted, you know, to get it on the record of what it is actually like to go through losing someone to suicide, especially someone so young, what my experience was like, quite unfiltered, in a quite unfiltered way. But also, you know, I've been through this enormous trauma, an enormous amount of grief. I think I've learned a huge amount over the last 5 years that has just been invaluable to me. I've gone through something, well, gone through a childhood trauma. And actually, I've learned an enormous amount about my own mental health to the point where now I've been working in mental health for almost 6 years. I wanted to get that on paper because, you know, a lot of the time when you read stuff that's a bit self-helpy, it can come across as being very clinical. And to a young audience, anything with clinical white coat, it's not going to be read and taken in. And I thought, I'd like to think I'm a quite a relatable, approachable and sort of understandable person. So, you know, I thought it was important to get my experience down on paper and try and hopefully then inspire people to follow suit and take some of my lessons that I've learned. But writing it, the process of writing it was just incredible, absolutely incredible. I wrote the book and I called it This Book Could Save Your Life because I was just like, you know, everyone needs to know this stuff and we need to adapt policies, blah, 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 to help people. And I wrote it without realizing this, but I think actually it helped me so much, so much. And we talk a lot in sort of mental health and well-being around journaling. And oh my goodness, is there power in just sitting there with your thoughts and writing it on paper? And I spent 3 months just writing about my experience. And for the first time, a lot of stuff came out for the first time. It was just an incredible experience for me. And to then be able to process some things I'd really stuffed to the back of my head and really tried to ignore. Once I felt safe enough, and it did take a while, it just poured out. And it was just such a useful experience.
Yes, completely powerful to have it written down and having it documented for everyone. But I love the title of the book, you know, Breaking the Silence Around the Mental Health Emergency, because it is a mental health emergency. And, I was thinking about this with various other guests as to why there isn't just the outrage that, you know, young people are dying, you know, a leading cause of death in young people, and it is preventable. You know, why aren't we putting billions into research to work out how we can actually save each and every young person?
Precisely. And I think actually you can be led down a route of believing that we've sort of solved this mental health problem and that we've ticked the box of awareness. But I don't think we have. And all you have to do, I mean, you mentioned research, and obviously it's apt that we're talking about it from a research perspective, this podcast. You know, we've made massive strides in mental health awareness, but the research level, the public donation research level to mental health research is so small. I mean, it's shockingly small compared to the likes of heart disease and cancer and the, you know, the big research funders. It's really, really small. And that to me shows me that actually, whilst we have a massive awareness of mental health at a very low level of depth, we really lack mental health understanding and empathy for what some people actually go through and the effect that it can have on some people. And that's why I wanted to be really honest about what it was like losing a 15-year-old brother to suicide. I mean, that is shocking, absolutely awful. And that for me is a real big driver of what I do, trying to open conversations, trying to tell the truth about what it's like. And it's only when you're in this world, you realize just how horrifically awful it can be for certain patients. I mean, across the board, psychosis, that's just the most horrific thing to go through. Clinical depression is an awful thing to go through. You talk about, I've got friends and people that I know that work in PIC units, psychiatric intensive care units, and the stories you hear from that, these are people that have lost their lives to illness. And it does sometimes feel like we're not as angry and not as passionate about this as we should be. And that for me is reflected in the public research donations and public research budget and even mental health charities. It still feels very top level, very mental health in a very shallow way. Whereas actually the real impact needs to come from anger and passion about the really deep stuff about dealing with psychosis, dealing with clinical depression, dealing with suicide, and putting the funding there. And so, yeah, part of my job, I guess, is highlighting the fact that, hey, suicide's still there. It's still absolutely awful. And I do think more people need to be vocal about that and supportive of this issue in the same way that we are, incredibly, with cancer and with heart disease and with those sorts of illnesses that do have a massive amount of public support and public pressure for funding. We are yet to see that level of passion for mental health, which I absolutely think it deserves.
Yeah, completely. And it goes back to what you say. It's fundamentally, I think it's the stigma and the shame around mental illness. You know, people have feelings of guilt, I mean, you know, and they blame themselves and family members. I mean, your response that you described absolutely, in my experience, is, you know, is pretty universal. And it's just completely different to other forms of, you know, serious illness. I mean, we really need to grasp that. I mean, that's almost the biggest issue from my point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm an engineer by my that's what I went to uni to do. I've worked in sort of engineering. I feel like I was like born to do that job, like loved Lego, and then I worked in a boatyard for a few years. I was like engineering mind. And you know, I'm not working in engineering now, but I still have that mind and I like to fix problems. I wouldn't be working in this if I didn't think we're on the cusp of really creating massive progress here. It's a solvable issue, and that's really positive. It's all very incredibly solvable. And actually, psychosis is a great example of that. The progress we've made in terms of treating psychosis is absolutely amazing. We can very confidently treat early onset psychosis. It's pretty easy right now. And that, I think, should give so many people hope that there are people out there doing an amazing amount of research. There are lots and lots of things happening. And the solution is almost there. But it's a case of bringing it all together. We need the education piece. We need the health piece. We need the research piece. We need it all together and the stigma bashing stuff. I'm an engineer. Like, I wouldn't be wasting 6 years of my life trying to push for this if I didn't think anything was going to change. I have a lot of hope for the next decade and 2 decades for how much is genuinely going to change. And it only takes a flick on Google to see, a search on Google to see just how many really exciting projects are going on at the moment that could absolutely change people's lives and hopefully save a lot of people's lives as well.
Absolutely. Do you want to tell us a bit more about the work you're doing with businesses like Wagamama, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so businesses, where do we start with this? There's a huge push at the moment for people to deal with internal staff mental health. A huge push, rightly so, because employees know that they deserve to be looked after by their employer, and employers also want to help keep their staff and keep their staff happy and productive. The problem is not a lot of people really understand how they're doing it. And I guess for me, you know, I've always just been sort of the person that likes to chat to people and likes to listen. And again, engineering brain likes to solve problems. And so I've worked with a few companies now on really trying to understand how businesses can help their employees and what are some of the problems there. And my biggest client, and I absolutely adore them. In fact, actually, it was after Sam died, I didn't eat anything. And it was the first meal I had after that. It was the first bit of food that I kept down, and it was a Wagamama's. And so it feels very full circle now to be working so closely with them. But really, it's about trying to help staff and also trying to help society through the partnership with Wagamama. And especially in the hospitality industry, it's not got a very good history of mental health and being a mentally positive place to work. So really trying to come up with solutions to that, work with their people team. And it's obvious things like collecting data and understanding what people are dealing with and actually, you know, cost of living. How do we know whether the cost of living crisis is something that we need to tackle internally without asking? It seems obvious, right? But how do we know that the cost of living crisis is something we need to deal with internally? Or is it actually that people are struggling with another issue? You don't know if you don't ask. And that was one of the early things I started with them. But it's a journey. And I think for me, it's always been a case of just bringing my story to the table. As soon as you introduce yourself and you say, this is why I'm doing this, so this, I lost my brother, all the barriers are down. Everyone's happy to talk about the deepest, darkest things of their life, which is great, because what it means I can have really vulnerable conversations with people and understand actually how we can help going forwards. So I do love Wagamama. They're a great team and they're trying their best in a really, really challenging industry at the moment. Hospitality is just, I mean, talk about COVID and what it did to hospitality. It's a very, very challenging industry to work in. So really I'm trying to understand that and help. But look, my mission is pretty simple. I'm not going and I'm going to do this for a very, very long time. I don't think anyone should want to kill themselves. I don't think anyone should have to die from suicide. I don't actually think that anyone should have to face depression and face long bouts of mental illness. It shouldn't be the case that we have that happen in society. So I'm going to do what I can to help on a personal level, on a professional level, on a government level, to try my very best alongside an amazing sector to improve this all round.
Wow. Well, thank you, Ben, for your energy, your optimism, your absolute inspirational level of drive. I mean, you know, wow. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Future Makers Brain and Mental Health. You can find more episodes of Future Makers wherever you get your podcasts and more on Oxford's research at ox.ac.uk/brain. Thanks for listening.